Hello and welcome to an extra seat at the best table in this, or frankly any town. Yes, this is the place where I chat to an utterly brilliant person over top-notch food, and they open up like a clam. My guest today is a superb actor and writer who consistently creates characters which are detailed, clever, and often hilarious, such as Sister Den Flickster in Getting On, or the Government Director of Communications Terry Coverley in The Thick of It. She's been in plenty of films, including Notes on a Scandal and The Invisible Woman, and she's just won a Best Actress BAFTA for her moving performance in the film After Love, in which she plays the newly widowed Mary Hussein. It's the brilliant Joanna Scanlon.
In order to make that scene work, it meant that I had to put the milk into the tea before I poured the water on from the kettle. Every time I did it, I thought, this is an offence against tea making.
For this episode of Out to Lunch, I've come to London's Covent Garden to a restaurant called Margot. Margot is the name of a sausage dog, which I believe was once belonged to one of the owners, and it's got nothing to do with the restaurant itself, which is Italian. It's sort of glossy, shiny Italian. It's very good. I loved it when I reviewed it. I've been back many times. I'm pretty sure that Joanna Scanlon loves her Italian food, and I think it's a very good fit. We have a table downstairs. Let's get inside.
Hello.
Hi.
Lovely to meet you.
Very lovely to meet you too.
Isn't it a joy?
An honour and a joy.
Have a seat.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We have a point of contact, which is we both discussed filth with Miriam Margolyes.
Ah. Yes. She's discussed it with you in this context.
Well, it has to be said, she's basically been discussing with me since I was 10 years old. But I've known her since I was a kid. So, you know, I have some very, very early memories of filth with Miriam. That should be a podcast in itself, don't you think?
It really should, yes, it really should. I'm surprised she hasn't done that, actually.
I don't know. I mean, there's still time. Should we put some context on this from your side as to how you came to discuss filth with Miriam?
First filth I discussed, or rather listened to from Miriam's side, was many, many years ago, one of my very, very, very early jobs, which was the production of Vanity Fair. And Miriam was playing, I think, my mother-in-law in it. And Miriam would sit, as I'm sure if you know her well, you will have experienced this many times,
Yeah. And
recount these wonderfully filthy stories. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the way in which she would...
There's no filter, is there?
It's full of richness, because it's not just filth, is
no.
it? I mean, it's clever filth and interesting filth and intriguing filth.
And very human.
Very human. I mean... Not all relatable, but it's...
Oh, look, we've all come across a soldier masturbating in a tree.
But I always love the way she proclaimed herself very, you know, loud and proud as a lesbian and then say, I sucked him off and I sucked him off.
Amazing, isn't it?
It's absolutely brilliant. You go, yeah, OK, I'm working on understanding how that works. But then, many years later, I did a film, The Invisible Woman, in which I played Catherine Dickens. Now, of course, Miriam is the women of Dickens.
She's
expert.
Done a one-woman show called Dickens Women for many, many years.
So Miriam wrote to me after I played this character. So after that, we were exchanging kind of, you know, here and there. And then I wanted to make some videos a couple of years ago during the lockdown process when there was very little else going on, which I called Sex Lives.
You'd solicited women to write in with their... experiences which became Instagram posts.
That's right.
this ended up with you sort of recreating one of these between you and Miriam online on Zoom, is that right?
That's right. Miriam and I played a aunt and niece in which we had a very full and frank discussion. And Miriam was so up for this. I mean, the hat's off to her in 100 ways, but really for doing that. Because she wanted to just tell it like it is. So we ended up doing these just improvised chats playing two characters.
Yours being someone discovering a polyamorous lesbian relationship where two of you are active, one of you watches. I think Sally might have been the name.
Yes, Sally.
And it does result in the remarkable line uttered by Miriam, which is, well, I'm lost for words.
That's the one, isn't it? I'm lost for words. How do you ever get Miriam Margolyes to the point of being lost for words?
Because she's a great actress and she can play against type. If anybody wants to catch up on any of this, they can go to Instagram, go to, I think it's sex_lives, and they can read a lot of brilliant submissions from women describing what they got up to in lockdown.
Yeah.
It's certainly diverting.
It meant a lot to me to with Miriam because my uncle was gay. He introduced me to food and good food. That's what I wanted to reference with Miriam, was a deep, close, loving uncle. I think Miriam has that spirit.
She does. Now, you've mentioned good food. You have a menu in front of you. We have some salumi. You get to choose first. You're the guest.
I've had asparagus 3 times in the last few days, but I think I'd like to have it one more time.
Excellent. It is asparagus season as we speak.
Because it's the season, yeah. Because it's the season. So please may I have some asparagus. And then tagliolini al astice.
Yes.
Please, the lobster pasta, chilli and lemon.
And I'll start with the vitello tonnato, the veal with the tuna mayonnaise, and then I will have the monkfish with fragola.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. After Love, the film for which you won the BAFTA, is an extraordinary piece of work. Can you describe in thumbnail, for anybody who hasn't seen it, the basic premise?
Yes. A woman who has converted to Islam many years previously to marry, and because she has fallen in love with an Islamic boy, finds herself bereaved after his sudden death, and going through his things, finds that he has had another secret life over the water in Calais. They live in Dover. And she goes to investigate what happened and who he was and what that mystery other woman might be.
Certainly the first 10 or 15 minutes, you barely say anything. You barely have any lines whatsoever. And I'm wondering, as you were sitting there reading this script, which I know you had to audition for, it wasn't just offered to you, was it? You had to be...
Oh, I really did have to go through my paces for that, yeah.
And you're looking at it. What was your feeling about it as you read it on the page, as an experienced writer yourself?
Well, you know they say about making a film that you make 3 films. You make the script initially, you've got the film you're making in the shoot, and then you've got the film that's made in the edit, and there's 3 different films. Well, the film that was the script at that stage, it had a lot of what we ended up with, but there was a whole story from before he dies, Ahmed dies.
That's not a spoiler, because he dies in the first 90 seconds of the film.
He does.
And it's an extraordinary piece of cinema, the way that's portrayed.
Isn't that?
Yeah,
it really,
just brilliant.
Do you know, the only thing I can think of as you say that is, in order to make that scene work, everything had to happen in very kind of clean sequence, but in order to do that, it meant that I had to put the milk into the tea before I poured the water on from the kettle. Because of the way the fridge was in the kitchen. And so I couldn't make the cross twice.
Right.
So I had to put the milk in. And every time I did it, I thought, this is an offence against tea making.
Detail. How many times did you shoot that sequence?
Quite a few. Because, of course, the actual shot is this very, very slow moving camera. So to get the camera moving at exactly the right pace, that was the thing that took time. It always is with filming. You know, they say, oh, how many takes did it take? As if the actor is responsible for fucking it up, really.
Mm-hmm.
But generally it is to do with camera and to get... because it's a film. The choices that are being made about that frame and that through that lens is everything. We are just material for that. Thank you. Oh, not what I expected.
Classic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Have you finished the salumi?
But you know, you could leave them there and they might get picked at as the time goes by.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Water. So what you were expecting green spears...
I wasn't expecting it to be peeled.
They've been peeled.
Yeah.
They've been... What else is going on there? It looks like a few petals.
Yes, there's some very pretty petals. There's very marigold petals and... I don't know what that is. Sweet William, I think. Petal. And then... some parmesan, which was promised, that we knew about the parmesan. But you normally, of course, it's rude to eat asparagus with cutlery.
can do what the hell you like.
So you eat it, but then with it, when it's been peeled, I'm not sure that's the case, so I'm going to try it with the cutlery.
Do whatever you like. You will not be judged by this side of the table, let's put it that way. After Love, when you read it, the issues around it being a woman, a British woman who's converted to Islam, and therefore it's deep within the Muslim community, and the sensitivities involved with that. I know you did a lot of research. Did you hesitate?
I did. I do now, even speaking about that. I felt I had the safety net and the luxury of being able to base my character around Aleem Khan's mother, the director-writer's mother, because he had written it as a sort of in honour of her. I mean, it's certainly not her story, but it is. There's a lot about her as a woman that right. is in the character of Mary. So I met with her and spent time talking about her history, her own history and her own life and her own values and her own relationship to the faith, sufficiently to feel like I'm talking about one woman here and not just being representative of a movement or a whole faith or
a whole community.
Or a whole community and a whole culture. And I thought Aleem is his father came from Pakistan, his mother came from Walthamstow. They met where teenagers hang out in those old tower blocks that have now been knocked down in Walthamstow. And they met there when they were 15 and 17 and fell in love.
So there is a great parallel with the story as told in After Love.
It's not, and I think this is what makes it a special film and one that worked, if I may say so. But I do think it works as a film. And I that is because it's got specificity and authenticity at its core. It's not trying to tell us anything about Islam or what it's like to be a white convert to Islam. As such.
There's a very simple line in there where you say, I've worn the veil longer than I haven't.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it, actually.
Yeah.
And then, well, there's one other line. I did something for my husband no other woman could
do. No other woman could do, yeah. And we also had, I also had the support, if you like, of my fellow actors who were in the scenes of the funeral. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time with Suda Bakar, people that I'd worked with before, who were very supportive and said, you know, this is okay, I'm going to help you with your namaz prayer, I'm going to help you to try to integrate with this.
The other moment, and this is just pure curiosity, how long did you have to lie on your back in the sea for?
That was quite short.
I'm relieved to hear it.
That was quite short, but it was lovely. I've done loads and loads of sea swimming in my life, weirdly. I actually love swimming in cold water. I prefer it to warm water. And so that didn't bother me at all. What wasn't quite so fine was that we didn't have the money for any sort of proper rig for the camera, which meant that Alexander was holding onto the camera. And waves kept crashing over him, which meant that he was very heavy and that he was about to drop it directly onto my face. And
nice.
That nearly happened a couple of times. And I did, in that moment, actually looking back on it, I remember thinking, I just have to just take my chances. The waves will do what they will do. And we had a grip who was ginormous and he just held onto him. So Alex was holding the camera and the grip was holding the camera operator and we just had to roll with it. That was the dramatic moment. It wasn't about being cold.
Did you know when you were making it that it was working?
No. I think making low-budget independent cinema in Britain is a really arduous process. I think we were on it for four and a half weeks or something.
That's no time at all for a 90-minute feature.
Yeah, for a 90-minute feature. No time to do lots of retakes, no time to have lots of conversations, lots of practical things to handle. But what I did know as we were going through it was that it was a brilliant script, that Aleem had a vision that was very fresh, kind of beginner's mind to the whole business of storytelling.
This was his first feature, wasn't it? He'd made shorts before, but this was the first feature.
Yeah. And he's quite uncompromising. He comes in with something that doesn't come out of the box of things that have been made before.
Although you talked about, you know, you say that was a short period. When you were making something like The Thick of It, surely episodes of that were shot in an even quicker turnaround.
one day on the thick of it,
yeah,
I seem to remember we shot 35 pages.
Bloody hell.
I mean, looking back on that, it seems impossible. I'm going to have to ask Armando or Adam Tandy if that was really true. But I remember. But that was very different because we were improvising.
How much of it was improvised and how much of it was on the page when you were playing Terry?
It was a very nice combination of both. So I think we used to do the improvising first and then we would do the script last, seem to remember.
And but how often did the improvised version make the cut?
Loads of times. I remember when Armando first, when we did the very, very first version of it, which was three episodes, that he did struggle in the edit with two editors, but because there was so much material to get through. That's how they make documentary.
Sure.
They shoot, and then the real programme is made sitting in an edit suite quietly. But in documentary, for the 1 week that you might have in fiction to edit, in documentary you've got five. Do you know that asparagus was virtually raw? It was very different from how English asparagus would be cooked. It was really, really super fresh, like crunchy.
Good. My vitella tonnato was fantastic as well. I've mopped the plate with the bread.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host. Created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
When you first came across Peter Capaldi's Malcolm Tucker on set or in rehearsal, what was your take on that?
I didn't want Malcolm to lay into me. And I felt I had the way of disarming him. I did. He never, ever did. In the whole series, if you look at it, there's not one moment when he ever confronts Terry.
Well, there's one where you confront him.
Yes, exactly.
And he eventually comes around and sort of apologises. Mm. It's extraordinary. Mm. When I was watching it back, I was thinking, hang on, is Malcolm Tucker taking the piss here when he says, you're right, I've stepped over the line? No, he's not.
No, he's not. He's seen sense because Terry's made him see sense. Where was she in bloody Partygate?
Well, she was going around with a black bin bag cleaning out the bottles, wasn't she?
No, I think she was putting the orders in, actually, for the discounts that she could get from her old employer.
Did you feel when you were making the thick of it that you were part of the political conversation?
As I remember it, we did that first series, first three, then I think we did the next three, and at that point we were invited to some do in Westminster Hall or somewhere like that, and a few politicians came. And they started to say to us, oh, you know, everything is just, I mean, you've written our lives. How did you know, kind of thing. And that was the first time we looked at each other and went, really? This isn't exaggerated?
It's they quite are disturbing, isn't it?
Very disturbing. Now, Armando may have known that, and Jesse might have known that, because they'd been closer into that system. But I was really surprised, because I did think we were exaggerating. And I thought it was ludicrous. And I mean, obviously all those stories at the time about the enforcer, et cetera, were going around. But I didn't realise it was the chaos underneath that was accurate.
What do you make of where we are right now in 2022? We are talking the day after the release of Sue Gray's report.
I can't believe... I mean, aside from whether Boris Johnson should resign as Prime Minister, aside from those questions, that to allow what seemed to me to be useful, probably, arrogance to that extent, when the rest of the nation were living in fear of their own lives and the loss of those close to them, I suddenly hit me this morning. I just thought, that is horrendous.
It's also reasonable to suggest that Iannucci and Armstrong wouldn't have written it because it would be too broad and too arch.
They might have done, you know. Though.
Really?
I mean, I actually think they are... I don't think the thick of it has been out-thick-of-it-ed by these events, because actually I think Armando is very... he's very clear, seer-like qualities around political activity, and I think he knows how dark it gets. I mean, we perhaps might not, he might have not chosen to put it into a show because it is very dark. It's genuinely a fall of the Roman Empire kind of behaviour, I think. The loss of any kind of empathy or compassion or responsibility, I feel, is by our political class, is deeply upsetting.
You just won the BAFTA for Best Actress for After Love. And in that speech, you did reference a GP who had set you on a course.
He was a consultant physician at a hospital.
Oh.
He was a diagnostician. And I went to him because I had a breakdown, whatever. Sajid Javid has just come out recently and talked about a proper diagnosis for ME, chronic fatigue syndrome. And that was what, at the time, I was diagnosed with.
How long did it go on for?
It went on properly, as in I couldn't do a thing. Couldn't lift, you know, pull the skin off a rice pudding, as my grandfather would say, for a year.
Does he stage an intervention? What does he say to you that's so important?
Sat me down, asked me two questions, I think. One was, what do you dream about? And then said, was there ever anything else you wanted to do in your life? And I said, well, yes, I had planned and hoped to be an actor. And he just paused for a moment and very simply said, I think if you don't go back to acting, you'll be ill for the rest of your life.
It's an extraordinary thing to say, isn't it? Because it strikes me as being quite off the medical patch.
Yeah. Medicine is a very sharp and precise tool, isn't it? And it's also an art. It's a science and an art. And any medics that I've ever talked to have always said, the big picture is very, very important, but the way that medicine has gone is closer and closer into specialisms. And we do need those specialisms. My goodness, where would heart surgery be without them? But we also need that standing back and looking at the big picture, the examination.
It's one thing, by this point, you would have been in your just in your 30s, if my timing's right.
I was 30.
Yeah. How did you do it? It's one thing to say, I'm going to go back and be an actor.
Oh, golly, I had to strategise, you know. And in the meantime, I took a job at the Arts Council and then I sort of started writing. I hooked up with Jo Unwin, who now famously is a literary agent, and we knocked on lots of doors and said, please, can we have a commission to write this, this and this and this and this? And we wrote, I think, many scripts, maybe 10 or perhaps more, none of which got commissioned. But it was 17 years from Jo and I first starting on our... you know, script, to Vicky, Joe Brand and myself getting commissioned for Getting On. That was 17 years of writing scripts that
nobody wanted. Well, that's quite the apprenticeship, isn't it? But in that time, you start getting roles, being a jobbing actor, doing very well. You've said that you tended to get cast beyond your own age.
I think I was sort of born 45 or something. But I think I always had a quality of being much more mature than I actually am. And anybody who knows me really well will tell you I'm extremely immature.
Are you?
But I can put on a front.
Well, you're doing
brilliantly
right
here.
Now. Look at you. You know, we're a proper restaurant, all the manners.
Yeah.
Was there a point when, a specific point where you thought, right, I'm here now?
It is called a precarious profession. And you don't know. I was only this morning thinking, what happens if, and I won't say that, I went through a huge, complicated sequence of events which led to me being unable to get a job.
is there a part of you that's a catastrophist then?
Yes, I'm afraid there is, yeah.
Ah.
I've definitely got a sense of catastrophe around financial security and getting work.
But it's actually one of the problems, isn't it, of having what I think is euphemistically called a forward-facing job. So that if people see you on a screen playing Terry in The Thick of It, for example, on a very regular basis, there's an immediate assumption you're famous, you're therefore wealthy.
There's a game we're playing right now, even, which is that I am somehow special and different, and that I don't have the concerns of, you know, everyday life. Because I guess this started with that whole publicity machine in Hollywood, didn't it? You need to have an audience be able to kind of look to the silver screen for its sense of otherness and magic.
Yeah, you're a commodity. Once you're cast in a role, because productions are expensive, they need to recoup, whether it be by getting an audience big enough on TV so they can sell elsewhere or whatever, you become a commodity. And to make you a commodity, you have to become a special thing.
A special and different thing.
Yeah.
Otherness. I like ordinariness. I value ordinariness. I think it's much more interesting to not have a peripatetic job like mine, so that in fact, and this was one of the joys of lockdown, that you could go every Tuesday night to your knitting club. I think that's a great thing. But I am put in this other category. And so a lot of those prosaic and normal...
Jenna, are you basically saying you'd really like a proper job?
No. That's, at the end of the day, what I want is my cake and eat it.
Is that it?
I mean, I love my job. Absolutely love it. I mean, yesterday we had there was a very cold wind yesterday with very flimsy clothes on, and I just was having such a good time with my fellow actors.
What were you shooting?
Playing the scenes. We were doing the Larkins.
Right.
We were
okay.
out with we had a bus that was going wrong, a Rolls Royce that the battery failed on, and we were creating this imaginary world in which I was loving my daughter and wishing her well.
It's very generous and it's warm.
Very generous.
And surprisingly sexy in places.
Rude.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite rude. But H.E. Bates's books, which I would urge anybody who's remotely interested to read, because they are so wonderful, at the time was really modern. I mean, they talk a lot about Ma being in her see-through nylon 90s with her voluptuous figure and how Pop kind of lusts after that. And they talk about how she wants a spin dryer, and she likes plastic jewellery and all the things that would have felt very common in its day. And I think he was writing with this spirit of massive spirit of generosity for modernity as well as everything else. And it's ironic that it's become a nostalgia machine now.
As you mentioned, see-through 90s. You've talked about the remarkable number of times you've been asked to get your kit off for various roles. The Invisible Woman, there's a sign, obviously, in After Love. You've also said, really interestingly, that it's, you know, this is about being a part of your body is part of character.
Yeah.
The way we react to people who don't have the body perfect is kind of strange in itself. It becomes a shorthand for bravery, almost.
Mm. I suppose there's an inference from that that if I had a body like yours, I wouldn't get it.
Well,
you know, I mean, there's a condemnatory, really, isn't it? Within the bravery is
you're absolutely right.
Is an insult, veiled, gently veiled or ungently. If you put anything on a body, it's going to tell a story of some kind. It tells you what time of the centuries you're in, or which gender you might relate to, or which gender you wish to not relate to. You know, there's all sorts of things that come with clothing. So if you take the clothing away, you can use the form, the human form, to do other things. And it's a tool. And I think that is my bottom line, really, about taking clothes off. Yes, it enters a cultural conversation every single time. And that is partly about whether your body is acceptable or whether it's unacceptable, deemed by some, you know, jury somewhere else. But I think at root, as an actor, I have to use everything I've got. And that's voice, that's thinking, that's, you know, your motor system so that you don't bump into the furniture. You know, there's loads and loads of things. And one of those is my naked form, if and when it's usefully deployed. In terms of myself as a human being, I don't want people to look at me and think, oh, she's just a fat old cow. I don't really want that. But I'm prepared to do it in certain situations. I do, at some level, probably want to say fuck you to anybody who judges other people on their looks.
As we're speaking, a new series has started going out on S4C, Igola.
Yeah.
Are you always speaking Welsh or are you speaking English? I've got to say, I haven't seen it, so
no.
I'm just aware that you are speaking Welsh.
Yes, I am. All speaking Welsh. So this is a form of television production that's called, in Wales, Kevin yr Gefn, which means back to back. So there's a script, which started off in this case in English, and then it's translated into Welsh, and you do two versions of it as you're filming. So you do the Welsh version and the English version on every setup. So every angle, you will do both versions in English and Welsh. So the Welsh one is the one that's come out currently, and that is S4C, which obviously is going out in Wales, and then obviously on, you know, you can get it on all your Freeview and Sky and everything else. And it is also on BBC iPlayer, because BBC has a relationship with S4C. And you might remember the show Keeping Faith, that was a bit of a phenomenon because they had some 16 million views of it unexpectedly, and it had only gone on iPlayer. And then later in the year, it'll go out on Channel 4 as well. So that'll be the English version.
It's, well, to describe it as a murder mystery seems a little thin, because it's about the reinvestigation of traumatic deaths. You do the Welsh language version. You're not a native Welsh speaker, are you?
Dwi dysgu Cymraeg. I'm learning Welsh. I grew up in Wales, yes. My parents moved to Wales when I was three. I was educated there, and I lived there until I went to university. And I've all my family are still there, my parents are still there. So I'm still very connected to Wales and that life, that culture. And then I've worked a lot in Wales in English. And then I think somehow the two things came together and they said, do you want to have a go?
Was taking that job part of full circle returning to where you grew up?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's not full circle as in the end. Goodness me.
you are such a catastrophe.
You'll never work again.
But in the spiral, let's say, okay. I'm coming back into that Welsh prevail because that's what I grew up inside. And I feel that's the closest to who I am, really.
And catastrophism aside, Joanna Scanlon, how do you think it's all going for you career-wise?
Well, you know, I would hesitate to say well, but it does seem to be going well. You know, I get these kind of wonderful little jollies along the way, like having the time to be with you, Jane. You know, it's great for me to have this. To be invited for lunch is an absolute joy and a privilege.
Well, it's all mine. So I'm going to say, we can have a look at the dessert menu, but for now I'm going to say, Joanna Scanlon, thank you very much for letting me take you out to lunch.
Thank you.
It's been lovely.
I'm aware there's no such thing as a free lunch, but
pretty free.
As far as this goes, it is as free as it could possibly ever be, and absolutely lovely to be with you.
I'll just get you the bill. How lovely to have lunch at Margot on Great Queen Street in London with the fabulous Joanna Scanlon. Margot is M-A-R-G-O-T. Do look them up online, and thank you so much to all the staff there. You can rent or buy After Love on Apple TV and Amazon Prime, or stream on your BFI subscription if you have one. And if you love the show, do please follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please feel free to rifle through our archives to find vintage chats with the likes of the aforementioned Miriam Margolyes and Joe Brand, and the marvellous Jesse Buckley and Jamie Dornan, among many others, and then gift them to friends and family. Just send them a link. They'll be ever so grateful. Also, do comment, give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It does help us to make more. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged, and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The recording and mix engineer was Paul Brogdon. The assistant producers are Ronya Das and Bethany Hocken. The producer is Selena Ream, and the executive producer is Darby Doris. Next time, it's Line of Duty actor, yes, DS Ted Hastings himself. It's Adrian Dunbar.
And we kept talking it up. And of course, there were people, other people who started moving in, like Dave Stewart, Danny Lennox. And people like Lorraine would go, what is it about Crouch End that you're all up there, you know?